Top 100 Project
and action.
Hiya, you movie loving boys and girls. Welcome to the Top 100 Project, where we look back at the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. A little warning off the top, we will spoil this picture with abandon. I'm Ryan Ellis with my dance partner, my wife Bev.
That's me.
Alright, the coming attractions trivia for Singin' in the Rain, this week's film. Gene Kelly is one of nine men to direct an AFI film with himself in a starring role. Cameos not included. Who are the other eight?
Okay, Orson Welles, Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Spike Lee, Dennis Hopper, Quentin Tarantino.
Wouldn't include him.
He's not a starring role, he's an important supporting player. I'm out.
So I'll go in order. Buster Keaton was first in The General, Charlie Chaplin in all of his three movies, Orson Welles for Citizen Kane. You said all of them.
Yeah.
You also said Dennis Hopper in Easy Rider.
Yeah.
Woody Allen in Annie Hall.
Oh, of course.
Spike Lee, Do the Right Thing.
Yeah, I said that one.
Kevin Costner, Dance with Wolves.
Yes, of course.
And Clint Eastwood for Unforgiven. You included Tarantino. I think that's a bit of a stretch. I would say that's more of a
cameo. I really should have remembered Woody Allen.
And there's a bonus to this question. Name the only actor-director other than Kelly to share director's credit with someone else.
Hopper?
Nope. Buster Keaton.
Really?
His co-director was Clyde Bruckman.
Oh.
Who was homaged in an X-Files episode called Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose.
For The General? He co-directed The General with him? Oh, wow. I forgot that detail.
So there are the nine. Anyway, the Top 100 Project's 43rd film, Singin' in the Rain, was 10th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list between Schindler's List and It's a Wonderful Life, but got a nice boost to 5th in 2007 between Raging Bull and Gone with the Wind. Singin' in the Rain premiered on March 27, 1952. Then MGM released it on April 11th. The movie was not the blockbuster that An American in Paris had been, but it was another musical hit for MGM. Also, every critic on Rotten Tomatoes gives it a thumbs up, and 95% of audiences do too.
Mm-hmm.
That is pretty impressive because a lot of our previous films didn't get those kinds of numbers.
Yeah, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes is not common.
Mm. So you're going to describe it now for us with the skinny.
In this musical romantic comedy, 1920s era Hollywood actors struggle with the transition from silent movies to talking pictures. Gene Kelly is Don Lockwood, and Gene Hagen is Lena Lamont. Big stars whom the public think are in love, they're not. In fact, Lockwood falls for a new singing and dancing star, Kathy Seldon, played by Debbie Reynolds.
Or in a nutshell, Hollywood actors make successful film while fraternizing on company time. Or another choice I had for this is ADR saves the day! Now, if you listen to this podcast, you must know a little about movies. ADR, of course, stands for Additional Dialogue Replacement, which is what they do with Kathy dubbing the horribly voiced Gene Hagen. All right, so, what do you think of the movie?
This is definitely one of the best. During my first week of university, in my first film theory class, this is the first film my professor showed the class.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's a perfect studio film. It's kind of an example of a bunch of really talented people who know what they're doing, absolutely performing at their best, and it all coming together into this great, fun work of art. I mean, it's not the deepest film.
No.
But talk about joy. Like, talk about fun to watch. I don't think if you were in a bad mood when this movie started, you could possibly stay in a bad mood. Mm-hmm. It's just the joy of cinema personified in a movie about cinema itself.
A movie about movies.
Yeah.
I always love those. We had one with Sunset Boulevard. We've had some other ones. We'll have some more. One of my favorites was the same year, 1952, Bad and the Beautiful. Kirk Douglas and many others. That's the cynical side of movies about movies. And I've mentioned that to you more than once. We're going to watch that one of these days.
Yeah.
Maybe we should have watched it around this point. Maybe we can still watch it this next week or something. But anyway, that's a fantastic film too, but a whole different style than this. And you described in The Skinny, this is the silent era they're coming out of. So here's a movie that literally references the jazz singer and Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. Warner Brothers is going to make the jazz singer. We got to compete with them. And so there's my first trivia question for you. What is the name of the fictitious studio in this film?
What is it? It's EF? FM? F-E?
You're thinking of the studio head, aren't you?
All right. Then I have completely forgotten.
Well, that's R.F. Simpson.
Yes.
Millard Mitchell.
I told you there was an F.
Apparently that's a reference to Arthur Freed.
Yeah, that's probably why I remember
that
detail.
Even a line that Mitchell has, he says at one point, I can't visualize it. That's something that Arthur Freed apparently said to people. But the name of the studio is Monumental Pictures.
Oh, okay.
I know one thing I want to actually backtrack on for other movies. Now, people who may own old DVDs may hear us say in the beginning, when I talk about what studio released the film, I always go by what studio literally did release the film. But in many cases, the rights have changed.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the ones that will now have the Warner Brothers label on the side of the disc, as will Wizard of Oz, and I believe Gone with the Wind does too.
Because MGM sold all these properties.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So when you hear MGM and all the times we've mentioned them, we're not going to mention them too much more for a little while. I think this might be the last time, actually, for quite a while. Because musicals were going out of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly has gained esteem, kind of like Citizen Kane and Vertigo, and yeah, others, too. There are many movies that have gained esteem as years have gone on, but movies that are revered, I would put this in that class of being revered, that wasn't really at the time. It took some time for that to happen. But it was an MGM film, and this is kind of their swan song for a little while, in this style of, as you said, studio-made musical films.
Mm-hmm.
The next year they made The Bandwagon with Sid Charisse, who's also in this film.
Yeah, she's the dancer. Yep. The leggy mobster's
the
mall.
The legs, they're taller than me. And that was, I guess, really the swan song. Because the next musical we have is West Side Story, 1961.
Oh, wow.
9 years after this. But anyway, a silent era movie. And here we thought we were up the silence when we got out of the Chaplin films and Birth of a Nation and Tolerance.
It's worth remembering when you're watching the film or talking about the film that when they're talking about the silent era, it really wasn't ancient history to them, not by a long shot. To them, it was only just over 20 years had passed since sound had come to film. So it would be as though you and I were talking about the early 90s, something that, the invention of the internet.
And in many cases, a lot of technicians especially, but even directors and actors, I've said it before, they got their start in the silent films.
Mm-hmm.
John Ford was one. We haven't had one of his films in a while, but we will again with The Searchers later in the 50s. And John Ford started way into the silent era.
And it was a massive change that the industry underwent. I don't think that they've ever had a sea change like this since.
I don't know the digital, which has been the modern one, and they tried to make 3D be so big. I think some people even said that 3D is sort of the talking picture equivalent,
which of course,
I do too. But I think that's what they wanted it to be. Digital has been a huge revolution, and there's a documentary called Side by Side. I highly recommend it. Really,
yeah, anybody's interested in it. It's definitely a great doc.
And Keanu Reeves, of all people, is the host. Does a very good job, though. He's actually very charming in that film and interesting, and seems to know what he's talking about to a certain point, anyway. But as for 1952, not 1927, when the silence ended, or they didn't end then, but talking films came in 1927 with The Jazz Singer, MGM was changing in the 50s. Louis B. Mayer, who'd been in charge for so long, was being kind of forced out. And he was no longer really the powerful man, even though the studio was still making money, which is very ironic. You'd think that he'd be in power for a long time. I said to you a few days ago in an off-mic conversation that a guy who was in charge of production at Fox in the 70s, named Alan Ladd Jr. He greenlit Star Wars. Nobody else wanted to do it. Hard to believe that it was possible that no one would want that property. And then when he made a bad deal with Lucas, according to the studio, he was forced out. Even though they didn't get the kind of money they would have wanted for the sequels and even for the original film, because Lucas had the rights to so much, including, of course, the merchandising, he was kind of mayored. He was Louis B. Mayored.
But that was because he's the one that made that bad deal with George
Lucas.
Well,
bad is debatable. He's also greenlit a movie that if they didn't have the movie, they wouldn't have had the product either.
Yeah, that's a good point. And but they're not about making good movies. They're about making money.
It's funny how so many people talk about movies are such a business now, and it's all about the bottom line. And you've got the Marvel thing and Disney and some of these movies that are being made by those companies that are good, but they're also such a product. They're coming off the factory line. It's such a machine. That's true of other studios, too, in the modern era.
And it's funny because people think that this is the downfall of film, but in actuality, I mean, speaking of digital filmmaking, the system is more democratized than ever.
Mm-hmm.
It's cheaper than ever to make a feature film. And back in the 50s when Singing in the Rain came out,
that was not true.
Nobody, no amateur could ever have made a feature-length film. In fact, good luck making a short film.
And they wouldn't have gotten it released.
Absolutely not.
I don't know. I'm not sure when this changed. It may have been the late 60s, but there was a time when the studios and the theaters were linked. And that's one reason why you'd have a movie, Singing in the Rain, Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, you name it, that was in a theater for a long time, maybe years or at least a year.
Yeah. And that's another reason why the studios were so much more powerful back then. Not that they're not powerful now, but they really were just behemoths that could yay or nay projects.
The irony of Singing in the Rain is that it was pulled out of theaters after An American in Paris had won the Oscars. This was a traditional thing, especially if you won Best Picture, you get re-released. Now, An American in Paris was a year before. I don't think it was even a calendar year before Singing in the Rain. So their own property was pushed out.
Oh, yeah.
And American in Paris.
You have two big Gene Kelly movies competing against one another.
Ironically. And look at the one that's way more known, revered, liked, everything.
Hard to believe that American in Paris could have ever held
Maybe that's why Singing in the Rain didn't get the recognition from the awards bodies, especially the Oscars, because they thought, well, we awarded the musical by this guy in the studio last year.
So this is one of your favorite movies.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you like it so much?
I think it's way, way, more fun than any other AFI musical, yeah. with the exception of Wizard of Oz, which is right with it, but I would say this is even more fun.
Yeah.
You've seen it before. I've seen it several times, but it's still funny.
Yeah.
And it's hard for a movie that is a comedy, and this is certainly that among many other things, a musical, a romance, and even somewhat of a satire on
yes.
the change from the silent era. But it's a comedy too, and it is still pretty funny. Jean Hagen's not the only one. She is hilarious, and anyone who knows this movie knows how good a performance she gives.
Mm-hmm. She was nominated for Best Supporting Actress.
That's right. And maybe should have won. She was beaten out by Gloria Graham, who was in The Bad and The Beautiful.
Oh.
How about that? But I think that's what it comes down to, is that it's fun. But then again, the songs are fantastic.
Mm.
I've ragged on musicals a lot in our podcasts, and I'm not a fan, obviously, of musicals. But when they do it right, I'm a huge fan of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like to see talented people do talented things. This was one of the times I actually watched the documentary on the Blu-ray that we have, Christmas Gift. Incredible print, by the way. Almost flawless. Mm-hmm. Looked great. Yeah,
yeah, any fan sounded, of this movie. Blu-ray was
sounded,
excellent.
Looked and sounded great. But there's a documentary on it as well, which I had not seen before. And it's modern dance people from High School Musical and Glee and shows and movies I know nothing about and I have no interest in seeing. But they talk a lot about the dance sequences and the dance steps and what Kelly... Donald O'Connor, we haven't mentioned him yet. Donald O'Connor's in this movie,
oh,
too.
Yeah, yeah.
And Debbie Reynolds are doing, and they are incredible. I knew that was true. But hearing these people who know what they're talking about describe some of the sequences, I was watching that closer. So I'm glad I saw those things before we watched the movie because I saw even more in it than I usually do.
Mm-hmm.
I forget their names now, but that person from Glee was right. That is a great moment in that sequence.
Well, one of the great things about this movie... It's funny. It's funny. It's clever. The dancing's fantastic. The songs are fantastic. But it's dense. There's no opportunity wasted to entertain us, to make us laugh, to marvel us with some dance move or some great trick of singing or songwriting. And it's because of that that this film can be watched over and over and over again with a fresh appreciation each and every time you see it. And still just that great joy of watching it because it is just so much fun.
Some critic, it may have been the guy we mentioned so often in our podcasts, Roger Ebert, said it's always fun to see an actor have the joy of performance, but that comes through. It certainly does with Gene Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe he was faking it, but to me, you can almost see his appreciation, his barely being able to contain a smile when he's on screen with Donald O'Connor, especially in the Make Him Laugh number, but all the time he works with him. And ironically, Donald O'Connor has been quoted as saying at one point, much like other people who worked with Gene Kelly, that he was a tyrant. O'Connor, who was so good and obviously so talented, was afraid of making a mistake. Debbie Reynolds, now people may know this story, it's pretty well known in the industry. She was 19 when they made this movie, and she didn't really know how to dance. She
was a gymnast,
right? But she was not a dancer, and she had to learn, and you would never know that watching the final product.
No.
But Gene Kelly berated her enough that she was crying under piano. This is the story I've read so many times online. Fred Astaire found her there, and he was another MGM contract player. He was in the bandwagon the next year, and he helped her learn the dance steps.
There's a famous quote from her that says, "Singing in the rain and childbirth were the two hardest things I ever had to do in my life."
Well, she's the host of the commentary. Maybe she wouldn't on the commentary track. Maybe they would have cut it out if she had. But she doesn't badmouth Gene Kelly, nor does Donald O'Connor on that track.
Well, they got these incredible, iconic performances out of them. I think when it's all said and done, much like childbirth, you know, you forget the pain when you're left with this thing that you love, that you're proud of, and that's
that
probably the same.
Forever.
Yeah, the same as making, well, children don't last.
Well, the film does.
But this film,
I was ignoring your point about the kid. Michael J. Fox made that point about the Back to the Future films because he was working on Family Ties during the day and Back to the Future at night.
Mm-hmm.
He was pretty much not sleeping. And yet his point was, and I think Zemeckis said this to him, but he seems to agree with it, pain is temporary, film is forever.
Lucky for him that film was good because I bet there's some poor jerk that worked on like Jingle All the Way or something. It's like, I don't know, I think I would have rather slept.
Yeah.
Donald O'Connor was hospitalized.
Mm-hmm.
After the day of shooting Make Him Laugh. Apparently he was a 4-pack-a-day smoker.
Mm.
And when you watch that scene, you can see how you would need an Olympic-level lung capacity to keep up with that. But apparently he wound up in the hospital. That's how hard he was worked by Kelly.
Well, there's different versions of that story. I've heard that he was just in bed for several days.
Oh, yeah?
But whatever it came down to, he was wiped out. The people from Glee and High School Musical in that documentary talked about how impressive it is to do what they do in not entirely single takes, but so many long takes within a sequence.
And they make it look positively effortless.
Yeah.
Gene Kelly looks like he's light as a feather. And the whole film is light as a feather. Like, it is just so fun and buoyant, and it looks so fun and easy. But, you know, there's a lot of hard work. I mean, you're describing, no matter what went on behind the scenes, and you know there was tears and blood and sweat and hard work. But on screen, it just looks as easy as fun as anything.
I wanted to stand up and cheer it a few different times. That's impressive if you want to literally applaud a movie that you've seen many times.
In particular, the actual scene in the rain sequence that Gene Kelly does in the rain. I actually watched it again on YouTube. The camera pulls out to that wide shot, the crane pulls up, and he's swinging the umbrella around with that look of joy on his face. I feel it. I actually get flush in my heart. I can feel it. It's so affecting and wonderful.
The very famous story from that is that Kelly had a fever.
Unbelievable.
Different reports on how high it was, 101, 103. Either way, he was sick.
I know.
And he's shooting in a studio-created rainstorm. But to do that sequence when you're not feeling well is remarkable.
Oh.
Because, again, he's got that smiling, always smiling look on his face. And he must be feeling like crap. He should probably be in bed.
I can barely make coffee when I have a fever. I can barely get out of bed and do anything.
We were both sick about a month ago. And you can hear it in our voices. And here's a guy who's doing these physical things and probably ready to collapse.
They must have had like an onset doctor with a needle full of adrenaline and vitamin B and whatever the hell they give actors to put them to work. Whatever they were giving Judy Garland at the time.
Right, yeah, the uppers. Gene Kelly was also a director, so he would have been cracking the whip. Anyway, regardless of how much of a tyrant he supposedly was, a director has to be a bit of an autocrat. His co-director was Stanley Donen. We said that he shared director's credit. We didn't say who it was with until now. This was his second or third film. I forget what the number was, but he'd already directed On the Town. He would later do Two for the Road with Audrey Hepburn and Albert Finney.
He was young. He was only 28 years old.
Yeah, young guy. He's still actually alive, just a few months shy of being 90 years old. This is his only AFI contribution.
So he'll be still alive by the time this airs then.
Let's hope that, You mentioned the Singing in the Rain sequence a minute ago. That song had been in five previous movies.
Yeah, it's been the movie since.
The songs from this movie, with I think two exceptions, were all previous songs.
I know.
Arthur Freed had written them for many years before. I think we're talking back around the silent era, actually, back in the 20s. And they were maybe well-known numbers and well-liked numbers. But Singin' in the Rain wasn't sung in the rain in previous movies. And it wasn't, I'm dancing and singing. And it was just the Singin' in the Rain.
Mm-hmm.
And Gene Kelly and Stanley Donen and the writers, Betty Comden and Adolph Green, and obviously the other contributors too, came up with ideas for this.
I mean, you just mentioned the writers. They wrote the script based on these songs that were essentially picked for them by Freed, right?
Yeah, talk about being painted into a corner and then getting your way out of it somehow.
Yeah, but look what they did. Look what they accomplished with it. I guess if you think about it, the songs are somewhat generic to the situations. I mean, of course, a song about falling in love. Although Singing in the Rain isn't even about falling in love. It sure as hell is in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
God, like what a wonderful expression of infatuation that whole scene is.
The original script had to be that all three of them, and they sing in the opening credits, the three of them sing together, Kelly O'Connor and Reynolds, and they were supposed to sing on the way back from the premiere. I guess when they came up with the idea of how to fix the movie that's so messed up.
Mm-hmm.
But Kelly took it for himself and very smartly did. And then it becomes about, I'm in love with this girl and she helped save my career.
And talk about an iconic scene. Anytime you're watching a documentary or any kind of montage where they're talking about Hollywood films, that shot of him jumping up on the lamppost and throwing his hat up, it's a beautiful shot. It's a beautiful scene. And it's now just shorthand for cinema at this point.
I would say you're right about that for sure, especially for Hollywood filmmaking and studio musicals. Filmmaking entirely.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Even that sequence on that street was just a Hollywood backlot that was covered over some big tarp. They shot it during the day and they pump out all this rain. Apparently it was during a drought too.
Oh God. It barely looks like an actual street though. I mean, it screams studio, but still is great.
Yeah.
And as iconic and wonderful as that scene is, it still is only in contention for the best musical pieces in this film. Every single one is better than the one before because there's the Moses supposes sequence. Yeah. There's the Good Morning, which
with all three of them dancing.
I've been
together,
singing,
so
and I've been singing that song all week ever since we watched the movie. And of course, Make 'Em Laugh. I mean, that's your favorite, right? Make 'Em Laugh.
Well, from a fun standpoint, Singin' in the Rain is probably overall better, and certainly, as you said, more famous. But Make 'Em Laugh is pretty great. Now, on that note, Make 'Em Laugh is based on Be a Clown by Cole Porter.
Yeah, it's a pretty blatant ripoff, right?
It's one of the only ones that wasn't from the Arthur Freed catalog.
There was one original song, and that was Moses Supposes that I mentioned earlier, the song that starts with the diction instruction.
Mm-hmm. I said in the nutshell that one of them was ADR Saves the Day.
Yes.
And of course, we know that Kathy is so much better than Lena Lamont, the Gene Haken character. But irony department, Reynolds herself was dubbed by Betty Noyes in the Would You, Would You song, where she's supposed to be dubbing Lena. Okay, trivia question. What is the name of the movie that fails in the first premiere, and what do they rename it?
The rename is The Dancing Cavalier.
That is correct.
I can't remember. The Royal Cavalier? The Kissing Cavalier?
The Dueling Cavalier.
Dueling Cavalier.
And on that same note, what is the name of the movie that is playing in the premiere at the very beginning of the film that they're all attending?
The Royal something.
You're on the right track. The Royal Rascal. That is it. So getting back to the dubbing, though, this is something that we're going to encounter at least once more. Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady was cast to play Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady. Julie Andrews had played it on stage, and there was a big controversy that she didn't get the role. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that when we get to My Fair Lady. But Hepburn was dubbed as well. I think there was maybe two or three other versions of this story where the name was, I think, Marnie Nixon. Mm-hmm. And she voiced for a lot of people. So anyway, Singing in the Rain, you get that version of here's an ADR thing, but it's not even Debbie Reynolds herself.
The very scene of her ADRing someone else. And for the irony department, the actress that did that voice, she was uncredited at the time. She's gotten credit since, yeah. But she was uncredited.
I think I've read that Jean Hagen herself does the voice that Kathy's supposed to be doing the overdub, if that makes sense.
It's she like actually this said it for circle. Real when they were shooting it, yeah.
But Jean Hagen was a bona fide actress. She played this mm-hmm. dumb blonde and did it so well. And it is the performance that steals the movie. She and O'Connor, I mean, everybody's great. And but
this is a funny story about how Jean Hagen got cast. They originally wanted to cast Judy Holliday, mm-hmm. who was in Born Yesterday on Broadway, and they couldn't afford her, so she suggested Jean Hagen, who was her understudy at the time.
And Judy Holliday is one who won the Oscar in 1950 over Betty Davis and Gloria Swanson for playing the dumb blonde in that movie.
In Born Yesterday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The part about the movie that I liked the least, and we mentioned this before, with I think it was American in Paris. Your dad said this to me recently because he and his movie club were, I think they did watch this movie.
Yeah.
The part he liked the least was the Broadway melody sequence in Singing in the Rain.
Yes.
And that is, of course, done because they had the ballet sequence in American in Paris, which is what people always say is what made that movie so successful with the audiences. I guess that's true.
I don't think it was totally uncommon. I don't think after American Paris that Singing in the Rain was the next movie to do this, was it?
Well, it was a year or less than a year for MGM.
That's true. And they're so much alike. You know, they're both Gene Kelly. Mm-hmm. They share so much in common, the tone. I agree with you that it's probably the worst part of the film. It's the only weak link, which isn't to say it's bad. It's wonderful, but it sticks out like a sore thumb, style-wise, and stops the story dead in its tracks. How long is it going for? 10, 15 minutes?
Probably at least 10.
Yeah.
Just to show off.
Yes, and that says a lot about the similar ballet break in American in Paris. It's probably the best thing about that movie, while this, like, equally adept piece is one of the weakest things in this film.
The story that the ballet sequence is telling is mirroring the sequence at the beginning of the film that Don humorously describes.
Yeah.
He describes his early career. Okay, what is Don's motto that he says at the beginning of the film when he's speaking at the preview
dignity.
Crowd?
Always dignity.
Right, and then the funny visuals of that. Of mm-hmm. course, he has no dignity. Because he's a stuntman, he becomes the actor that he becomes later. And by the way, speaking of that, Gene Kelly might as well have been a stuntman at times, kind of like Buster Keaton in his films.
Because
in the sequence where he jumps up on top of that streetcar, you can tell it's really him.
Yeah, apparently he had a couple of mistakes when he was jumping into the car. Yeah.
Now, they don't show him jumping the car from the streetcar, the top of it. They do cut. But just getting on top of that streetcar is impressive enough. For their star, co-director.
Well, he's quite the physical specimen. Mm-hmm. He's an incredible athlete, and he proves it by wearing super tight clothes. Especially in the pants department.
But anyway, in doing the ballet thing, he does whatever he does to succeed and becomes a big success. He already did that earlier. Now they're just showing it all over again. He's being redundant. Like, I've never been on this podcast.
I like it, but I like singing and dancing. When the movie on its own without that is as good as it is, and the pacing is so immaculate and fun and it never stops, and the plot is well composed, and you're in the story, it's criminal to take us away from that. Like with an American in Paris, you're missing nothing. Who cares what's actually going on in the real world? Better to just take me to a fantasy land where people wear pretty costumes and dance. Whereas with this, you actually do get caught up in the story, and it's a little annoying to get pulled away, adept as this sequence is.
There are two guys in that documentary I mentioned a few times already that say, what is this modern Broadway melody thing, modern for the silent era going into the talking mm-hmm. pictures era, doing in a French Revolution film?
Their explanation is so weak.
Well, they say that he's a modern person who's been hit on the head and he has this flashback in his own brain to being in the French Revolution. Those guys are funny in that documentary piece, but they're actually wrong in saying that because the movie does explain
it. They do explain it. And it's actually kind of funny that the film itself is about the introduction of talkies into Hollywood, but that whole sequence really
doesn't require
silent,
talking.
No, it's a wordless storytelling and only like quite adept wordless storytelling.
Yeah, saying gotta dance is one of the lines in the whole thing. It really doesn't matter. Yeah, you're right. All right, let's get to the stars, the supporting cast, and all the technical people involved. Gene Kelly, the big star, his second of two AFIers, our last chance to see him. He'd, of course, have been in An American in Paris, On the Town, Anchors Away, where he dances with Jerry of Tom and Jerry fame. He was 39 when they shot the movie, 20 years older than Debbie Reynolds.
Yeah.
Like he was, I believe, the exact same age difference. Yeah. With Leslie Caron in the year before.
Hollywood loves their child brides.
Yeah. Now, originally it was going to be Howard Keel, who's known for Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, and then he was Clayton on Dallas many years later. I didn't hear if Kelly was going to direct and Keel was going to star, but Keel was going to be the man. And they changed it from being a Western type to being the Broadway type.
Yeah, it underwent quite a few changes in story and script.
Yeah. We've always mentioned alternate casting options, but sometimes they're very strange choices, and Howard Keel is way different than Gene Kelly. Debbie Reynolds, who, like Elizabeth Taylor in A Place in the Sun, was only 19 during filming. They both became such big stars, and they both slept with the same man at one point, Eddie Fisher, Carrie Fisher's father. Right. She was married to Debbie Reynolds somewhere in, I guess it would have been the 60s or 50s.
Yeah, they were good friends before.
And then Taylor took her man away. And Reynolds is still working after more than 60 years in the business. She made The Unsinkable Molly Brown, and Mother was probably her more recent well-known credit, where she worked with Albert Brooks.
But speaking of Mother, everybody knows she's Princess Leia's mother. That's probably our generation, how most people know her.
Yeah. She's great in this film, and she may not have been cut out for it in the beginning. Maybe someone else would have been a better dancer. They used Sid Charisse in the Broadway Melody fantasy sequence. She's very cute. She's so likable. And when you watch the Good Morning sequence, she keeps up with these two pros.
She really does.
Again, the people on that documentary pointed that all three of them running up the stairs towards the end of the sequence
and flipping over
the couch, they're completely in sync. How is
that
done? And not in fast cuts where it's like, oh, you see his feet and then the other guy's feet and then her feet.
Apparently her feet were bloody after that.
We talked way back when we did the Chaplin movies. Wow, they're so long ago now. It's hard to believe that they're so far in our past. But how he always wanted comedy to be done in a single take and a bit of a long shot. Musicals, same thing for the most part. Fred Astaire insisted on that.
Speaking of Charlie Chaplin, I was actually thinking about him, about how Kelly is such a militant perfectionist and drove his stars practically to madness. And I know with The American in Paris, the ballet sequence, he had this enormous budget. He was a tyrant, but so was Chaplin in a way.
Yeah.
And he was notorious for going over budget and for taking way, way longer than he should have to
doing over 100
films.
Takes sometimes.
We'll hear about it more. There's plenty of directors that
Stanley
work
Kubrick.
Like this. And you're never going to see a movie on the top 100 list that isn't made by somebody who's obsessively passionate about what they're doing and a perfectionist who just can't bear not having it exactly right.
Yeah, you can't be a nice guy and make a good movie, or a nice girl and make a good movie.
No.
Well, maybe you can, but it doesn't necessarily add up.
You can't call it in and make a great movie. I guess the exception would be Woody Allen. He keeps short days.
Well, so much of what he does, though, is done in the pre-production by what he's written for a screenplay.
And who knows how hard he is on himself and his standards.
When it's just him in the room
and
by himself.
And he's made plenty of pretty mediocre films.
Of course, yeah.
But
maybe he should be harder on himself.
Yeah.
For all kinds of reasons.
But the point being that these two artists, they actually shared a fair amount. You know, when they're during the Make It Laugh sequence, it's like we're watching Charlie Chaplin in Fast Forward. When he's doing the sequence with the dummy, or that he's having the fake fight with the dummy.
Yeah, it's a Chaplin-esque
and all
kind of
the stuff he's doing with his hat. It's funny because some of those Chaplin movies were actually playing at faster than normal speed. And yet Donald O'Connor looks like he's doing it even faster. And I don't think that film sped up. I think he's just doing it faster.
He's just
it's
that
insane.
Good.
It's like manic.
Yeah. And Donald O'Connor's next thing I want to talk about, the third star as Cosmo Brown. He's my favorite thing in the whole film.
His energy. He's just like a wound
and
up
and he's
spring.
Funny. Even in a lame line like when Kelly sets him up by saying, call me a cab. Okay, so you're a cab. He sells that and he's so likable.
Yeah.
He's also so nice because he's probably at least as talented as Gene Kelly's character is in this film. And yet he's only the musical director. Not that that's not a great gig. And he's obviously, he's part of the brain trust with everything that they do. And he's clearly Don's best friend. But he's still not really given the kind of credit he should be.
Well,
but he's
what
so likable.
They make him the musical director from being the background music player, the mood music player. All right, we're making, what does he say?
I can start starving and write that opera. And then he finds out he's going to be the musical department head. Finally, I can stop starving and write that opera.
So fast and quick. And like I said, the movie's so dense with jokes. He's a big part of that. And his delivery is just so sharp and witty. And he keeps moving from one thing to the next with alarming speed. But it's so much fun to watch. And he's super charming.
Yeah.
Great, really charismatic.
And yet, like Debbie Reynolds, he was only in this one AFI film. He didn't make any others that made the list. He ended his career with things like Toys and Out to Sea. His last film was Out to Sea. And one more thing about O'Connor, his part was intended for Oscar Levant. We talked about that in An American in Paris. Levant maybe could have played the comedy. He was kind of funny. He could certainly have done the piano playing, and maybe, I don't know if he could sing. I guess he could sing, but he could not have done Make Him Laugh. He couldn't have done any of the physical stuff.
I don't think he would have been even 25% as funny as O'Connor is.
And Gene Kelly may have been upstage. He may not have liked that, but I've never read a story that says as much. And I, like I said, I think his smile in the Make Him Laugh sequence and other ones is genuine. Either he's a great actor or it's legitimate.
I get the impression he just wanted to make a good movie. If he was the type of guy that didn't want to be upstaged, then he wouldn't have given these actors such a great platform. He would have given himself the part in Make Him Laugh. But instead, he let O'Connor do it.
And sometimes pulling rank on people is the right thing to do if you are the star or if you're the director, if you're the powerful guy. Even if you're not the powerful person, you've got to put the right sequence, the right scene, the right line of dialogue in the right character's mouth. Mm-hmm. The supporting cast, Jean Hagen, what a great performance she gives too. Hagen and O'Connor, to think that they're
so
second
funny.
Fiddle to mm-hmm. Reynolds and Kelly. She also was in Adam's Rib, where she played a similar character, kind of a dumb blonde, and then The Asphalt Jungle a few years before this. But again, only one AFI film. And this is one legendary AFI performance for her. R.F. Simpson, the studio head, the nicest studio executive of all time.
Biggest pushover.
Yeah, Millard Mitchell. He did a lot of westerns and died only 1 year after Singin' in the Rain came out in 1953
oh, wow.
of lung cancer. Another performance I definitely enjoy is the perpetually frazzled Roscoe Dexter, who's the director,
yeah.
Douglas Fowley. I read that he was based on Eric von Stroheim. I don't really see that from what I know about Stroheim, who was in Sunset Boulevard as the butler.
Oh, yeah.
When he was a director. Mm-hmm. A lot of these people are based on real people.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
Or amalgams of them. But he's very funny as the director. Once TV got big, he did more of that than he did movies. Which mm-hmm. actually, if you look at these old actors, a lot of times that's true. You see that the TV credits where they either had their own show. Donald O'Connor, I believe, had a show at some point. Donna Reed, I mentioned her on Wonderful Life, had her own show. Or they just guest starred in a lot of TV.
You know what? You episodes. See it happening now with Hollywood stars true. That were very popular in the 80s and 90s. They have their own TV shows now. It still happens.
Yeah. We mentioned Sid Charisse, who is also on the bandwagon in Brigadoon, and she's the one that plays the gangster mall character in the fantasy sequence.
The leggy gangster's mall.
Very talented dancer,
very
no doubt.
Beautiful dancer, yeah.
Yeah. She's also one of the many people that speaks on the commentary track. Rita Moreno, who we will see in West Side Story, our very next musical, which is 18 AFI movies from now. She's Zelda, and we see her several times in the film. We mentioned Kelly and Donovan already, the co-directors. This is the first time since The General that we've had co-directors, and we're going to have it again with West Side Story, Robert Wise and Jerome Robbins, and arguably with Fargo, because the Coen brothers, at that time, Joel was getting all the credit for directing, and Ethan was getting credit for producing, but they've shared it ever since, and we know that they always did co-direct. Yeah. Donna's last movie was Blame It on Rio, with Michael Caine and a young Demi Moore, which I saw maybe a year and a half ago. Way to go out. But I mentioned some of his other credits, On the Town, Two for the Road. So he directed different types of movies. He also directed Saturn III, I think it's called, with Kirk Douglas, a sci-fi film. So he was all over the place. The writers were Betty Comden and Adolph Green. They had written On the Town, and they would later write The Bandwagon and Anti-Mame, mostly known for the musicals, and they could write a good musical, especially when they're painted in a corner like they were with this one, like we said earlier.
Well, they're funny. They were a funny pair of writers, that's for sure.
And they were also on the commentary track. And I mentioned Arthur Freed, the producer. He also did An American in Paris and was uncredited for his work on Wizard of Oz. So he would have had three musicals.
Oh, wow.
And two very legendary ones. He once worked as a mood music setter, just like Cosmo does.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So this movie is based on him even more than we thought. Now, as far as the texts, behind the scenes people, the composer was Lenny Hayton, who was nominated for an Oscar for his music score. He won Oscars for On the Town before this and Hello, Dolly after it. But he did not win for this one. The cinematographer was Harold Rawson, who had a ton of credits back to the silent era, including Wizard of Oz.
The cinematography is an unsung hero in Singin' in the Rain. You don't really see a lot of people talk about it, but it's striking. You don't notice it because it's so adeptly executed. But that camera's on a crane. It keeps up with those dancers really effortlessly. And I was thinking, especially with those super long takes, you talk about the frazzled director in the scene where they're first introducing sound. I think that whoever the focus puller was on this film probably like gave himself a coronary. Took years off of his life. I can't imagine how hard it would be to execute that, and then how stressful it would be to execute that when the actors only have so many takes in them. And
working with the tyrant.
Working with the tyrant with this elaborate setup involving props and
Technicolor.
Rain or, yeah, Technicolor. That would have been really difficult to do, but the cinematography is beautiful and it's kind of invisibly beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to give credit to him. He deserves some credit.
He definitely does, yeah.
Nobody really talks about it.
That's right. This movie isn't usually ever mentioned in that way, except by people who do a long podcast about it like us. And we mentioned camera steps, you mentioned the long takes. Well, the editor was Adrienne Fazan, F-A-Z-A-N, and she would later win awards. She did at least for Gigi, which Vincent Minnelli directed. He was the guy who did American in Paris. But there are some bad jump cuts in this.
I remember seeing bad jump cuts before, and there's always some explanation in these movies that some of this footage just simply went missing or got edited out for censorship or one reason or another. What these terrible jump cuts are doing in this film, I have no idea. In an incredibly adeptly produced film... to have such an obvious error.
One was bad enough. I was looking down and taking a note, and I could see out of the corner of my eye the way it looks so weird.
Yeah, it's really strange. Mm-hmm. But other than that, the pacing of the film is really exceptional. You actually have to give the editors credit for it.
I would say one of the best paced films we've had so
absolutely.
Far.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's quite a bit of influence for this film. First of all, the dubbing. Glenn Close dubbed Andy McDowell entirely in Greystoke, a Tarzan movie, 1984, and Andy McDowell's accent was still so strong. When I first wrote the movie in a nutshell about how actors are fraternizing on company time, you said the artist actually applies to that too.
Yeah.
Well, there's an influence as well. The Artist is a movie about movies and about a guy who's losing his career because of the way the industry is changing. And that one won Best Picture somehow.
Somehow.
Anybody who knows anything about films knows that one of the ones we're going to cover at the end of this year is definitely influenced by Singin' in the Rain because it's A Clockwork Orange. And there's the perverted but very memorable reuse of that song that apparently Gene Kelly strongly objected to when he saw Malcolm McDowell sing.
He ran into Malcolm McDowell at a party and wouldn't speak to him. Yep. It was disgusted.
Because McDowell sings it while he's
raping
that woman.
But the only reason that song works in that context in Clockwork Orange is
the
because
irony.
It's the exactly it's such a complete polar opposite to its representation in this really classic iconic
and they use the Kelly version in the credit sequence of
Clockwork
Orange too. It's not somebody else singing. It's not a reprise of McDowell's version, so really hitting that home even more. As far as the awards and lists, there's a few here. The two nominations for the Oscars, but it didn't win, Supporting Actress and for the score. The National Film Registry has been honoring it since 1989, the very beginning of their little project, which is a good thing because the original negative was destroyed in a fire quite a long time ago. Thank God for Blu-rays and DVDs for that reason alone. The movie even made the top 10 on the prestigious Sight and Sound list a few times.
Yeah, it got number 4, didn't it?
And usually those lists are about the Citizen Kanes, the Godfathers, the Vertigos, the Raging Bulls of the world, even Apocalypse Now, but not usually about the more glossy Hollywood products.
Yeah, these are like bona fide film snobs that are calling this the 4th best movie ever made. And that's worldwide, too, not just Hollywood.
Because at least half of those films tend to be foreign films.
Mm-hmm.
There were 3 tunes on the top 100 songs list. That does not surprise anyone, I'm sure. Good Morning was 72nd. I think it should have been higher than that. Make 'em Laugh was 49th. And Singin' in the Rain was 3rd. And it was 16th on both the top 100 laughs and top 100 passions. I'm a little surprised it was 16th on the laughs, but I do think it's a very funny movie, so I'm glad they honored it by putting it so high.
Yeah.
And the last credit for this, number 1, top 25 musicals.
Yeah, I guess its main competition would have been The Wizard of Oz. And they kind of danced around each other on the top 100 list between 98 and 2000.
Yeah, Oz was higher the first time and then it was lower the second time.
Yeah.
Singin' in the Rain went up and Oz went down.
In my opinion, Singin' in the Rain is by and large a better movie. Better musical, especially.
Musical theater. So as we go out here, a little wisecrack moment. If Don was so in love with Kathy the first time he saw her, why didn't he use his studio connections to try harder to find her rather than let it go weeks before he just stumbles across her if she gets a job with his studio?
Yeah, considering that she was working for his studio, it doesn't seem like it should have been that hard to
find her. She's fired by Lena. Lena gets her fired for the whole cake in the face thing. But then she would have had some kind of tax form or something with the company, with Monumental Pictures, and he can't seem to find her. But anyway, a parting thought.
You know, on the list, there's a lot of films that are innovators, like Easy Rider or Wizard of Oz, and there's some that are the perfectors. And Singin' in the Rain is most certainly a perfector. The spirit and energy and just, like, technicality, sheer entertainment factor of this film is what every musical strives for. But above and beyond all of that, I don't think there's many movies in the world that are more fun to watch than this.
Yes, I completely agree, and that's why I think it's one of my favorites, is because I just enjoy it. Some of my favorites are not even 1/10 as enjoyable as this one.
Yeah.
All right, so goodbye to Singin' in the Rain. Up next on the Top 100 Project is our first Western since Stagecoach 25 AFI movies ago. And this one is Gary Cooper's only AFI-er, High Noon.
I've never seen it. I'm looking forward to it.
And the coming attractions trivia for High Noon. Very simple, pithy one. True or false, High Noon is the only Western that was included in the inaugural year of the National Film Registry in 1989. It's very easy to find.
Yeah, it's
if
true.
If anyone wants to know, they're going to find this out in a heartbeat.
But if you don't want to look it up, you can find out the answer to that in next week's podcast for High Noon. In the meantime, for more trivia about this movie and every other movie that we've covered on the project, please go to our website, top100project.com, where you'll find trivia and lots of other fun stuff. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. And we'd love to hear what you think of Singing in the Rain. Please give us a shout, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
We hope this podcast ain't been in vain for nothing.
And cut.